Thanks, Lauren, and thanks for sitting down and pretending to listen. I wanted to start with telling you guys that this is, in March when I decided that I would do a talk to try and fill out our symposium, this is absolutely, positively nothing like what I was planning on doing. I thought I'd have data, I'd be able to show you some cool graphs. Life gets in the way, as is often the case in science. I have nothing, so I'm gonna do a nice little song and dance about what might happen and what we know from other studies about nutrient enrichment and wetland insects. So from historical figures, we can get a really good idea of what's going on, what society feels about different issues. And we know this from newspaper clippings and magazine articles, but I really like movies. And so if we look at the 1950s when we start seeing some really creepy, fun movies about creatures from the Black Lagoon and its sequels, The Revenge of the Creature, The Creature Walks Among Us, you have this idea that society views wetlands as a very dark, foreboding place where monsters come out and they want to wreak havoc on civilization. And we know this is true. We have it and this time and previously that the idea of wetlands is that the only good one is a drained, ditched, and filled in so that we don't have to deal with them when we don't have to deal with the mosquitoes that they produce. This view of society continues in the 1970s when the first iteration of Swamp Thing comes about. And the original Swamp Thing that first came out had a scientist named Alex, and Alex had a very beautiful wife, and Alex's colleague was very jealous of him and made this accident happen in the lab so that Alex turns into this ugly, dark thing that must retreat to the swamp and try to avenge his accident and try and come back and capture his wife again. Well, he does kill the colleague, his wife doesn't recognize him, and he goes back to the swamp. When these are made into movies in the 1980s, Swamp Thing and the Return of Swamp Thing, this starts off the same way. I mean, there's a little bit of it, but actually Swamp Thing now becomes this more environmentally friendly thing. He's protecting of the wetlands, and he's just searching for some love from the women that he tries to drag away. There's actually a really interesting story about Swamp Thing when it's brought back, but I won't go into it at this point. So this change in the way that society views wetlands and how media represents them is all because of Ducks Unlimited. Well, maybe not all of it, but it starts because of Ducks Unlimited, and they showed that they were having declines in the waterfowl population. And we started to see that wetlands have actual value, that there are breeding habitats for waterfowl, for fish, for animals that we actually care about. And in 1997, we saw that swamps and floodplains together provide almost $20,000 of services per hectare per year. These services are various things of food production, you know, fish and crops. There's also water quality issues, habitat, recreational purposes, all these things that are very important about wetlands, which you guys already really know. Unfortunately, even though we're no longer in that ditch, drain, and fill plan anymore, there's still human impacts that are going to severely affect wetlands in the future. Anthropogenic eutrophication is expected to triple by 2050. Of course, that's a few years old now, but it's still supposed to get quite a bit higher. Additionally, we're also starting to create wetlands for wastewater management, and these wetlands already have increased nutrients in them. So we're getting changes from what our normal insect community should be. And so what I'm going to show you guys today is, this is my cartoon representation of wetland communities. The large green things along the sides, if I can have a pointer there. Large green are some sort of macrophyte, we'll call it typha or Chenoplectus. We have some predatory bugs in orange. Some grazers or shredders in purple. They're kind of mayflies in this case. We have some red mosquitoes and chironomids around the bottom, nice gray pretty fish, and algae growing in this particular wetland. So our expected impacts as we dump fertilizer into wetlands include both structural changes to the wetland as well as food web changes. Our structural changes are, you know, changes in the physical structure both within the wetland itself as well as around the wetland, making different things, allowing for more nutrients to go in. And our food web changes would be changes in the food availability, as well as changes in the predator presence and the efficiency. So the first thing that we usually think of is a nice, beautiful green mossy lake. That's the first thing that happens. We get lots amounts of algae. But in wetlands, if you have enough time with nutrients, you're actually going to get that decrease in algae because of the shading by the macrophytes that come to dominate the wetland. So there is expected to be this increase in food availability for a short time. If there's a prolonged eutrophication, there's often changes in the algal species that are there. Research done in the Everglades showed that the algae actually was supplanted by cyanobacteria, which was less nutritious and therefore less less of a good food base for those organisms. Again, there's those interactions with the macrophytes, which depends on the permanency of the wetland, as well as which macrophytes are present. If you have floating vegetation, then maybe you're not getting as much shading out as if you have the tall shrub grass on the sides. We also would expect there to be impacts via the microbes that are colonizing. With the increase in the macrophyte vegetation, there's an increased litter going into it, and of course you're going to see more bacteria, more fungi colonizing those things. There is likely to be species shifts, increased nutrients in other systems. We know that you can get one colonizer who kind of overruns the place and takes out everybody else. And this may lead to changes in the palatability of that litter, whether something is willing to eat it anymore if it doesn't taste quite as yummy, quite as good of peanut butter. So in this case, we have our nice, happy little wetland, and some runoff comes in with extra fertilizer. We'd see a massive amount of increase in the algae, bringing down some of the oxygen levels and leading to the dead fish that are floating on the top with X's for eyes. Because of the increase in the algae, we'll say that this happens to be one that the grazers happen to really like, and you'd see increases in the mayflies there, also increases in the mosquitoes, and a little bit of decrease in the predatory insects because they would have problems finding things with all of the algae present. Our predator increases, we know that there are predictable interactions with nutrients, but it's hard to know until you get into specific ones. Increases in macrophytes have been shown to lead to increased cover for fish. You can get more nurseries and more areas for those fish to develop. If this increase in eutrophication also increases the permanence of the wetland, you would end up with an increased likelihood of fish, particularly of larger fish. And this may lead to differences in what the fish are eating. The insectivorous fish might decrease if they're having problems finding their prey items, but you could get an increase in algivorous fish, maybe gulping a few of those mosquitoes. So in this case, this is to look at what might happen to the predatory fish in this case. So here we see that at this point, the macrophytes have taken over. We have increased litter around the bottom, that brown triangle types of things. Increases in the amounts of chironomids, which we know to happen in certain parts. Possibly the same number of fish, but just slight increases in the macroinvertebrate community. And what we know the best about macroinvertebrate communities and eutrophication actually comes from work done in the Everglades by Richardson and his colleagues. And they found that there's an optimal phosphorus loading that's actually above what the natural conditions are in the southern parts of the Everglades, but it's below what's actually currently going on in the area. So there is, as we see in most disturbances, there's an optimal where there's an increase in biomass for those that have, with phosphorus loading, but there hasn't been a shift in the species that are present. This is different from what we expect from other things. Work in my lab has shown that mosquito species are very susceptible to different nutrient regimes. Particular species like very low phosphorus bacteria, bacteria that's grown in a very low phosphorus condition, and a different species prefers the one that's grown in a very high phosphorus condition. I'm not going back to Aristotle like Dr. Resch did, but I'll go to Virgil instead. As we've made this problem, the Aeneid is a good reminder of how hard this thing is to correct. The gates of hell are open night and day, smooth the descent, and easy is the way. but to return and view the cheerful skies. In this task, the mighty labor lies. We've done quite a bit of damage to our wetlands through draining, ditching, and filling. We're doing more damage as we dump fertilizer and nitrogen into these areas. To correct this is going to be a very mighty task that we're not going to be able to fully solve, but we can do the best that we can with more research. And to look at view at how society views these wetlands again, Swamp Thing is becoming more and more of a gentle creature in love with nature, and our society has had more and more of a desire to protect these wetlands, which we're very fortunate to have. So far as that, when I was looking for pictures, there's a new Muppet character. He comes from the swamp, and he is his own little Swamp Thing. So now we're trying to teach children that wetlands are great places. And with that, I'd be happy to take questions of what I can possibly tell you. Sure.
You know, a lot of Costanza's values of ecosystem service were based on wetlands for nutrient removal. That's what he knows.
Right.
At least in Northern California, we're building a lot of these stormwater wetlands that, you know, just because of runoff from streets and urban areas. Have you looked at those at all, or are they building those in Southern California?
We don't get as much rain in Southern California as Northern California, so we don't see very many stormwater wetlands. We do have, there are wetlands that are being built alongside rivers so that the drain off that comes from dairy farms that we still have in the area, they can remove the nitrates before that water goes down to Orange County for some reason. I don't know why rich people don't like green water. I can't get it. We don't have quite as many of those. More of my understanding is that even though they're building these wetlands, there seems to be a real lack of communication between those that are building the wetlands and those that are involved in entomology programs or dealing with mosquito programs. It's very interesting listening to the two sides of how we need these wetlands, and yet nobody wants to go out and treat them for mosquitoes or to deal with that side of the issue.
Yeah. Related to this, you know, you could argue they have conservation value, but the last thing that the wetland managers want is an endangered frog in them, that, you know, then worrying about how they're going to manage them. Just one last thing, you know, we're looking at what's driving nutrients, and it's, at least in our wetlands, it's nitrogen.
Uh-huh.
It's not phosphorus, because we're uplifted.
Right.
From the ocean, I think you are too.
We are, yeah.
So nitrogen.
Nitrogen is actually what I want to do my research on, and if I had been funded, I would have been happy to have shown pretty graphs of how nitrogen impacted that. But most of the research that is out there right now is the phosphorus loading of the Everglades. That's where a lot of the money has gone, and so we know what happens with phosphorus more, but not so much with the nitrogen, which is hopefully what I'll be presenting next year. Bob. What? No. Stop. No.
So we've been talking about the, you know, the ecosystem services that are provided. And one of the things I've thought about, the last few I've thought about, is how to take that monetary value and apply it to people so that they can kind of see its importance, not just locally, but, you know, nationally. Do you think it's possible for all the research you're going to do, or research that has been done, we could take those services and actually say, look, your taxes are this much higher because this amount of wetlands is destroyed. And if we take this money and fix these wetlands, the gain to you as an individual citizen who might not care could be this much. Do you think that that's a possibility at the end of a lot of this research?
I think that, so this has to do with, if you didn't hear, this has to do with can we relate the numbers that Costanza and others have shown as values for these ecosystems as tax dollars. If you destroy a wetland, you have to pay so much higher in taxes because of all the services that now need to be done. I think that Costanza provides a really good starting point for that. I would love for an economist to be able to come in and take those numbers and be able to transfer them. I have a brain for certain numbers, but money, as a grad student, I don't have it. So I just don't have the brain for money as others. I think that you can show that, I mean, we're trying more with the mosquito abatement districts. A lot of them are trying to show that we need these wetlands for particular reasons, but we also are going to have to continue to spend so much money to be able to maintain them. And they are looking at different ways and relating, you know, if we can use fish in this wetland, that's a savings to the taxpayer. And I think that at least that's a starting place to go with. Somebody much smarter than I am going to have to take that over. Right? Sorry.
In Pennsylvania, at least, or in the eastern part of the United States, there's a lot of interest in wetlands at the township and municipal level now because a lot of these municipalities are coming under TMDLs for their municipality, nitrogen, phosphorus, especially nitrogen. And so 5 years ago, they weren't really interested in protecting wetlands with the right kind of ordinances. But now they see the value of wetlands helping them meet their TMDLs and keeping their ag runoff from getting into the streams and denitrifying the denitrification before the nitrogen stream and so on and so forth. And so now there's an extreme amount of interest among these townships and wetlands and creating ordinances to protect and enhance wetland function because now they get it. Now they get that, you know, before it was like, okay, now they denitrify or not, but now it's like, oh yeah, I need them.
Look, I don't have to put chemicals in to denitrify the water. I can just let it sit there for that long and it'll go away. And there's pretty birds that come in too. That's good.
It's actually pretty exciting. These were the interest in developing ordinances at local levels and techniques is really there now.
There are, and along with that, there have been really interesting teaching activities that now come along with that. My favorite is if you go to the Illinois State Department, they have how to make an edible wetland, and you make brownies as the base, and then you use fruit roll-ups to make the land and the water, and then you put in lollipop trees, and I thought it was a really cute way to try and teach, you know, fifth graders about what wetlands are and what you would find in wetlands. So it's really interesting seeing how much it's changed over the past few years. Thank you.